Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Beckham.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Haggerty.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show, the very first of 2017. We hope you had a very Merry Christmas and we wish you a very prosperous and healthy 2017. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And we're going to take a slightly different tact with the podcast in 2017, and we'd really welcome your feedback either via Facebook. Our Facebook page is Not The Footy Show, or the website is notthefootyshow.com. And what we're going to do is John and I are going to pick a topic to discuss, one topic each per show, and of course we will also have special guests. And our special guest on this first show is a young footballer from Western Australia who backed himself, went over to Germany and is playing in the Bundesliga over there and doing really well for himself. And we're just talking about some of the problems he's faced. One of those would obviously be learning the language and being able to communicate with the coaches. But John, the first thing I want to talk about is obviously last year was an Olympic year. And as we've seen so many countries, and this is not just Australia, funding for certain sports is based on a four-year cycle with the Olympic Games in mind. Now, my question now is that really the way to go in the modern era? Is the Olympic Games still as important as everybody makes it out to be, as we're seeing more and more sports being introduced to the Olympic Games? I think, therefore, to put all the funding on that, I think World Cups now are maybe even usurping the importance of an Olympic Games. And if you look in a lot of the sports, and one that's dear to your heart, hockey happens every 2 years in between the Olympic Games, as it does with several other sports. And I think maybe the administrators need to look at two-year cycles rather than four-year. I also think they need to give the athletes more security, because what worries me, and we've seen this in Australia, we've seen it in Great Britain, where failure at the Olympic Games has seen cuts in funding. We've also seen players culled from squads that were elite squads for various sports. Now, I was talking to somebody I know in the UK who was one of those elite athletes who has been culled, and he goes, look, we didn't perform, I accept that. He goes, what I don't accept, though, is what has happened before the culling happened, in that he said everyone was running around covering their own backside, trying to justify themselves being given another four-year contract through to the next Olympic Games. And he goes, there were some people who've now managed to achieve that, who, if they're honest with themselves and looked in the mirror, don't deserve to be there. Now, again, I think that sport at that level now is almost like the army. What's happening is the army gets in a recruit, they break them down, they mold them into what they want them to be, and then when that person leaves the forces, there's always been that complaint that they don't reprogram them for normal life. And I think we're seeing that with elite athletes now, in that they're dedicating their lives. Sure, they get the fame. Some of them get the money. A lot of them don't. But they are then being programmed for a world of elite sport. But then what is happening now with this funding and the culling of a program after 4 years? Unlike professional athletes in, say, football or rugby union or even AFL, where they know their contract is coming to an end. So, for example, we're seeing in the A-League at the moment, players whose contracts are coming to the end of this season, they can start negotiating now, 3 or 4 months out, for what is going to happen after that season. These athletes don't get that. It just comes down to the coaching or the high performance units deciding who's going to be part of that program in the coming year. There's no 3 month warning for them to prepare their lives, and a lot of them would expect or be hoping to still be a part of that, as it's something they've only known since their teenage years. And the other thing I feel on top of that is, if they've been dropped from that squad and then they want to get back, how can they do that? Because there is no sort of underpinning program that they can drop into but still get that elite or access to that elite coaching, training, etc. So that's my little thing at the moment, which I think people should think about. And I don't like this four-year cycle, and I think that sport in a lot of countries needs to revisit this and the funding issues.
I think we've got to remember that we're looking at two tiers, essentially. You're looking at poor sports and you're looking at rich sports. Now, it tends to be Olympic sports are poor sports. And you might say, oh, what about equestrian? They've got to have lots. Yeah, they've got to have lots of money, but there's no money in it, really. I'm sure there are for the very top riders, and they do very nicely out of breeding, thank you very much. But to actually just to be a competitor, there's not much money in that. There's not much money in water polo, and there's certainly not much money in hockey. So these sports that rely on the four-year cycle of the Olympics are already at a disadvantage. Their athletes have to do just as much training and be just as fit as the rich sport athletes, your footballs or your baseballs, etc. The athletes work just as hard, if not harder, in some of these sports to get fit and do all those sorts of things. Do we ask professional athletes in the rich sports to take less money? Do we ask Cristiano Ronaldo to just maybe take $20 million less a year? No. Will that affect Cristiano that much? Is it about time that there was a bit more of a community outlook amongst the sports people and protect and look after themselves? Ronaldo doesn't need all of that money. He can get by quite happily for the rest of his life on probably half of it. But we still have this ideal that, oh, but they've got such a short time in the game, we've got to pay them all this, rah, rah, rah. We'll pay them all that, not just the selected ones.
But you made a very good point there when you said that these are lesser sports where they're not getting paid as much, yet they're still having to be professional athletes to all intents and purposes.
Absolutely.
They are training as hard, if not harder. And that, to me, is the crucial thing here. And I remember talking to a coach from one of those sports, and he said the problem we have is our athletes go around saying that we are semi-professional because they have to have a job in between their training because there isn't the money there in that particular sport. But he goes, to all intents and purposes, they are professional. So how can we change the mindset of the public? And he goes, and this particular coach said to me, not just the public, but also the media, because he says that's the key thing. Because to bring the money in, you need to get the media coverage. That's the way it works today. If you get television coverage, if you get people written up in sports magazines and social pages, etc., then that attracts sponsorship, which can then see the athletes paid the money. But it's a very, very difficult situation when the athletes are, to all intents and purposes, professional, yet everybody's regarding them as amateur or semi-professional. And then, as you touched on there, the Olympic Games now is actually an exact example of that, in that we've got high-profile, well-paid sports being played at the Olympic Games alongside these other sports. And I think it's time. I know that this will never happen because we've talked about it before. It's business, and the Olympics needs those sports, so they claim to make it make money. I'm not sure that they do. I think if the Olympics were marketed properly, you would still make money without the likes of golf and tennis being in the Olympic Games.
Have you ever met anybody that was excited about the upcoming Olympic football tournament? Excited. No. Genuinely excited, like people get excited. Oh, the 100 metres.
No, that's absolutely not.
I mean, it's a nothing tournament in the world of football. Completely has no relevance whatsoever.
The only place it does have relevance these days is the women's tournament, because the women don't have as many men's tournaments as the men. So the two big titles for women's football are the Olympic Games and the Women's World Cup. So it has a lot of kudos in women's football, but in men's football now it means absolutely nothing.
Do the women play under 21s as well, or is it full national teams?
They do, but it's fairly new. It's not been around as long as the men's tournament. It doesn't have that history yet, but it is certainly, as I say, it is probably the second biggest tournament in women's football at the moment.
I mean, just on one point, the idea that football is in the Olympic Games as an under-23 tournament is a joke, an absolute joke. You know, no other sport would have the gall or the gumption to say, oh, you know what, we're not sending the best to an Olympic Games. They're the only ones that don't send the best.
Well, the other thing is, and we're going off on a slight tangent here, if you're going to make it an under-23s tournament, then the IOC should turn around and say, well, okay, forget your under-23 World Cup. This is your under-23 World
point.
Cup.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. But back more to what you're talking about. you know, we're moving into a new age for professional sport, okay? People shouldn't underestimate in the history of sport how important the light bulb was. The invention of the light bulb changed sport in ways that we can't quite comprehend now, okay? The next big, real change in professional sport was television. And the change we're living through now is the internet. It's the internet age, for want of a better term. And sport is in this arena where it's transitioning from the traditional media that it's always relied on to this new media that it really doesn't have much of a handle on whatsoever. And that space is providing some of these lesser known sports with the opportunity to get into it and lay the groundwork right now. And a lot of the larger sports are starting to understand and realise this, you know, AFL football here with all the apps, and you get signed up to Telstra and you get games streamed live to your phone and all the rest of it. But there's still a vast space there that's left for sport to take up in that new digital media realm. And that sports are going to have to look at doing things like broadcasting themselves. Don't wait for the dream check from Channel 9 to get you through the next 5 years. Go out there and invest a little bit yourselves and create your own.
Well, as you know, John, and this is an unashamed plug, we do have a streaming service, which we've been doing. Now, some of the sports that have got on board with our streaming, they've reaped the benefits. I mean, I should mention friends of the show, the WA State Futsal Centre in Fremantle. We've been now streaming their finals for the last 3 years. They are getting over 2,000 views of every game we do for them. That is because they market the stream, they let people know that it's available, and what we're putting out there is a quality product. Now, if you do that, you can reap the rewards. Of course, if you get those hits or views to the streaming, then that in turn brings in sponsorship. The great thing since we started that streaming is we also now, the sponsorship options that are there have come light years since what we could do before. Now you can actually drop adverts into the broadcast. Again, it means there's different ways of doing it and different costs attached to doing that, because it means you've got to have a mixer, etc. But the thing is, now you can do all these things that you see on television. And it just comes down to having a budget for it, but also marketing it and making your audience know that it's available.
Oh, what you're able to do on a laptop and a couple of digital television cameras these days is remarkable. The quality that you can achieve with some clever production easily rivals stuff that you can see on giant commercial networks who spend thousands and thousands of dollars on infrastructure. It's, now that things are digital, it's all done inside a computer chip. So everything can be changed. We've all seen the Microsoft ad where the woman sits there on a laptop computer and changes a Marvel Comics film, you know, and she's doing it on a laptop just with a finger going, changing what the director's seen as his vision. And now we can do that with sport. So the opportunities are quite boundless for sports at the moment, if they choose to take them up and if they can look far enough ahead.
We'll wrap this topic up shortly, but I mean, I think one of the other things that I find with this four, as we call them for want of a better word, the lesser sports, is if you look at the Olympic Games again, we had Channel 7 in Australia were offering that, you know, there were more coverage, more channels, whatever. But the key thing I remember reading a report about was people now, it doesn't apply to people of my age, I don't think, but a lot of the younger generation want to watch games when it suits them. Whereas I don't like to watch a game after I know that it's taken place, because I probably either know the result, but I'm old school. I like to watch it live then if
Absolutely.
It's happening. But there's a different generation coming behind who are programmed differently to the way we were. Now, the interesting thing I think about the Olympics was you have the Olympic broadcast channel, which basically films every event throughout the Olympic Games. Now, to me, why the IOC didn't have that online, probably, again, because they need the TV rights, but I would have rather been able to watch the sports I wanted to watch rather than having to watch the sports Channel 7 thought I wanted to watch. And if you look at, again, the sport dear to your heart, I think it was hockey, I think there were only 10 games were actually shown live across the world. They were all otherwise put out on delay from the Olympic Games. So, and there were three sports, I think volleyball, hockey, and I forget the other one, were actually on a delay, which in this day and age, it seems bizarre to me. But if these sports want to get up and survive, then they need to negotiate and say, no, if you're going to show us, it has to be live. But getting back to my question about should it be a four-year cycle, should we take more care of these athletes and give them that opportunity? At least if you're looking to cull them from a program, I think they need to be told a lot sooner than when they announce the new squad of players or whatever.
Oh, you do bring up an interesting point as vis-a-vis, you know, do we put them on some sort of four-year contracts, or how do we deal with this? One of the arguments against central contracting that was started by Cricket Australia from cricketers themselves, older cricketers, was that these blokes are too comfortable. They've got their $100,000 a year playing Sheffield Shield cricket, and they can average 30, and they can keep walking home with their $100,000. Why not make it incentive based? So, on the one hand, we've got to look after the athletes and all those sorts of issues and make sure that they've got medical facilities, etc., etc. But on the other hand, we don't want to mollycoddle them. We want them to think that they have to go the extra yard and try more and do all those things. Keep them hungry, exactly. So where is that line between keeping them alive and keeping them hungry?
Well, again, as we're coming to the end of this conversation, I agree 100%. If you look at the older players in a competition such as the A-League, you know, you don't give 35, 36-year-old players two-year deals, because if you look at Diego Castro as an example, last year he was outstanding for the Glory, rightly won the Player of the Year. He is not playing the way he played last year. His commitment looks to be a long way off what it was last year, because he's got a two-year deal. He's now comfortable, 35, 36, it'll be his last pro contract, and he's just, thank you very much, I've got my retirement secured, I've got what I wanted. And it may not be a conscious thing, it may be a subconscious thing.
Absolutely.
And I'm not saying that he as a man has gone, oh, I'm going to sit back now and not work. But sometimes he's just got that security now. And you, like you say, sometimes maybe you do need to keep them a bit more hungry.
And sometimes you see people that, you know, are happier and are more confident with that security of knowing what's going on, and etc. And they can actually just let all that other stuff go and just concentrate on what they're supposed to be. But there's other people that need that to push them, need that insecurity to push them. They need to be striving and achieving all the time.
There's no answer. There's no easy answer.
No, there's not.
But I just feel very, very sorry for some of these players. And as I said, having spoken to an athlete in the UK who was culled, and how he said what was horrible about it was it turned a team that was a team for so long against each other, because they knew that they were looking to revamp the squad for the next 4 years, and people started stabbing people in the back. And that's not good in any sporting culture. We know it happens, but you usually get rid of the bad apples. But I just found that really, really sad that friendships were broken over it because a team underperformed.
Well, you know, usually those sorts of issues can be, when it comes to culling, can be settled by just allowing coaches and coaching staff to do it. But unfortunately, in the modern era, it's also now the domain of administrators and the thought police. And so players aren't necessarily being sidelined over strictly playing issues.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, it's time for us to turn our attention to our guest for this podcast. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to catch up now with Stefan Valentini, who played for Balcatta here in the WA State League, or the National Premier League's competition, and is now plying his trade with Braunschweig in the German League. Stefan Valentini, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hey, mate.
Well, it must be good to be back in Australia for Christmas, because you're avoiding the winter in Germany at the moment.
Yeah, it's good to be back in the hot weather and getting away from that cold weather over there.
But I believe playing professional football in Germany, they've given you a training program. It's no rest. You've got to train every day.
Yeah, never a day off. Always got to be training, always going to be at the gym, but it's what I want to do. So, yeah.
Being something you wanted to do, has it always been your dream to play professional football?
ever since I was a little kid when I was first playing. Yeah, it's always what I've wanted to do, and it's not going to stop. I'm going to keep going and going and going.
There must have been a stage, though, where you suddenly realised that it could become a reality. Do you remember that?
Yeah, when I first started at Glory, that's when I really thought things are getting serious with football. And yeah, and now, yeah, I hope it stays as a reality for the rest of my career.
You're of an age where the Glory obviously was around as you were growing up. How important was it having an A-League team or a former NSL team in your backyard to give you that goal?
Yeah, when I was younger, I was a big supporter of Glory, always going to the games. And yeah, and then to have them want me to play at their club, yeah, it was massive for me. It was like that big stepping stone that I felt was stepping into the reality of football.
How old were you when the Glory came knocking on your door?
I was about 18 years old when they came.
So it's quite late, because some people would say they'd have been on the radar 16, 17, but you obviously had never given up hope.
Yeah, it was actually when I moved to Melbourne and I was playing over at South Melbourne when they came knocking on my door. So it was a bit later, but I think it was for the best, and I was learning different things, and then I went there, and yeah, and everything seemed to work out pretty good.
The move to South Melbourne, and there's a lot of WA players have done that. Is the league better there in Victoria than it is here in Western Australia? Did you feel you learnt more from that competition?
Yeah, I honestly thought that over there in Melbourne it was much more like more people put more effort into it, and the league and the coaching and the training was much more what I think was harder. And yeah, I really think over there is very good, but I think here is also very good too.
A lot of people will remember your exploits in the FFA Cup, but suddenly you disappeared and you've ended up in Germany with Braunschweig. Can you tell us how that came about?
Yeah, it all happened so quick with it in the FFA Cup, and everything was, yeah, just really happened so quick. And then, yeah, now I'm in the space of 3-4 months, I ended up in Germany, and yeah, and now I'm living in Germany playing for Eintracht Braunschweig.
How difficult was it, because you're moving to another country, you don't speak the language, I presume you didn't speak any German when you got to Germany? That must have been very difficult. It would have been a real culture shock.
Yeah, I got there, it was in the negatives degrees, it was snowing, the training pitches were covered with snow, the language, I had no idea what to say. I had some little idea of some words, but really to speak to people was very hard. Yeah, it was honestly very hard for me, and not to be with family and friends, it was very hard.
I've spoken to a lot of young players that have gone overseas, and they've found that language barrier, being away from family, just too hard in the end, and they've ended up coming back. What was it, do you think, that made you stay there, fight it out, and get the success that you're getting at the moment?
Since I was young, like I said, I've always wanted to be a footballer, and I knew when I was playing football that there had to be a stage where I had to walk away from it all for the best for me and my career. And as hard as it is to be away from family and friends, I know at the end of the day it's all going to be worth it, and that I'm going to follow my dream, because it was my dream since I was a little kid. And yeah, so that's the way it is for me, and that's in my mind, and I know that that's what I have to do.
Now, I believe at the end of last season you were getting regular games, which must have helped a little bit in settling in, because you could really express yourself on the pitch.
Yeah, straight away it felt like, wow, like I'm playing, and I was loving it, and everything was working out good, and my mind was just on football. It was hard with the language and everything, and making like good relationships in the team, but to play, it always keeps your head high, and yeah.
This year it's been a little bit difficult, I believe, because you've got a sort of senior player dropping down from the first team, sometimes taking your place, which must be really frustrating. How do you keep motivated this time around?
The way I keep motivated is just, I know that everything will work out. I know that there's a plan for me, so I will just keep going and going. And as much as something that I can't control, what else can I do? The only thing that I tell myself is that I can work hard, and it's only on me. I can change it. I can work as hard as I can, and if I sit there and mope around and not and whinge about it and not do anything, then it will never happen. So if I keep working hard, then I think it will really happen, that I can progress.
The good thing is you are getting game time. Okay, you're not getting a start, but you're still getting on in the matches. So that must be almost like a carrot to you to keep pushing.
Yeah, every game I'm involved with, helping as much as I can. And yeah, to be involved every game, of course, it's good. And I would love to start more. I would love to get more games from the start, but I'm being involved, and as long as I'm playing football and training at a high level.
Do you feel your game has matured and has changed since you've been in Germany?
Yeah, the German coaches over there are very hard on that, and they, especially in training, and I think that my mental and my physical side of the games are much more stronger and mature, and I feel that, it's pushed on you to do it, and it's a good thing, because it makes you much more stronger mentally and physically in the game.
Is there an area that you could pinpoint where you think you've improved as a player?
I think power, it's to keep going and going, and the physical side of the game, like, much stronger. Tactical over there, the coaching is, like I said, they're very hard on the game to do things the right way, and tactically I think I've improved a lot too.
Tactically, I would have thought would be the hardest thing, because again, as you mentioned, you have the language barrier. So have you had to have other people explaining it to you in English?
Yeah, when the coach will explain, and maybe it's a bit too fast for me to understand. The coach will come to me. He will tell me if I don't understand anything. But at the end of the day, it's football. You can see what they're saying, and I have better knowledge now in German, so I can learn more. Like, I understand more when they're speaking, and yeah, don't really have so many problems when I'm trying to learn the tactical side. But yeah, of course, sometimes it's a bit hard, but everyone's always open to help, and yeah.
There'll be some people that'll say, oh, you're playing in a lower division in Germany, you'd be better off playing in the A-League. But do you feel that, as you've touched on there, the exposure you're getting to the German game and the skills that they're teaching you on and off the pitch, mentally and physically, are actually going to make you a better player should you want to come back?
Yeah, at the end of the day, I know that in Europe it's football, 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 and it's massive over there. There's so many clubs over there. Everywhere is football, and by going to a lower league over there and working myself up is what I always wanted to do, and I feel it was the right thing to do for me to progress. And yeah, to learn in the lower leagues over there as well, in the German football, it is making me a much better player, but it will make me an even better player in the future.
And I mean, if we look at Lucas Neal, Kevin Muscat, and all those guys, Mark Schwarzer, they all started in lower league teams and all went on to have glittering careers. I mean, do you take that in the back of your mind as well?
Yeah, of course. You see how it all worked out for them. And but at the end of the day, everyone's different. Everyone learns a different way. But I really think by doing it this way can really benefit me in the future.
I mentioned at the beginning of this interview that you're on a break at the moment. Are you sort of refreshed your mind as well and gone back and said, you know what, I'm going to force my way into the starting lineup for the second half of the season?
Yeah, of course. It's good to refresh your mind, come back here, see family and friends. It really gives you that motivation more and more to go back and keep fighting, of course, and never stopping and making sure that, yeah, at the end of the day, I want to be into that team and starting, and yeah, I think it will happen. It's on me. I just have to keep fighting.
Do you have any words of advice for anyone that might be listening to this that's around your age and thinks, should I go to Europe and back myself?
just what you're thinking, what you want to do, just do it. Don't hold back. Just make that decision and just go for the risk. And just if you believe you can do it, do it.
And how important is it though to listen to the coaches?
You have to listen to the coaches, and of course, and take in everything they say. Don't answer back. Don't nothing. Just learn from it and keep going.
Well, we wish you, Stefan, all the best, and we'll be following your career with great interest. Thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, mate.
Hi, I'm Gordon Banks, and I'm listening to Not The Footy Show.
Yes, welcome back to the first podcast of 2017 from Not The Footy Show. Well, that was my thoughts a little bit earlier about whether the Olympic Games squads should be based on a four-year cycle. We're now going to turn our attention to John's point as we take a different approach to Not The Footy Show in 2017.
Well, I'm actually following your lead slightly, Ashley. Once more, it's sort of about money, but I have concerns about the status of women's sport. Now, it's been going through a resurgence in this country in recent times and around the world. There's been far more people far more prepared to embrace women's sport, and seen the rise of people like Ronda Rousey in the world of mixed martial arts. And it's not something that you'd typically think women would be interested in or that people would be interested in watching, but they are, and she's done very well for herself despite not being able to punch. Now, it's all very well and good for us to have these wonderful feelings about women's sport and want the girls to have all the accolades they deserve and want them to be able to compete, and we want them to be able to be rewarded for the efforts they put in. But when you take up professional sport, there's only one thing that matters, and that's bums on seats in lounge rooms, because that's what keeps the professional sport world rolling. Now, if you watch a game of the women's league football in this country and you look around a stadium, you might count 300 people. If you watch a big batch ladies game, you might see 3,000 or 4,000 people. You might, in stadiums that hold 40,000 to 100,000 people. If you watch a game of women's hockey, you might get a couple of hundred people there, but you don't get many more than that. Ever. Maybe the grand final, they might get 500 people there to an A-grade grand final. I'm worried that we are investing too much goodwill and warm wishes and not enough foresight and forethought into women's sport. Now, it's all very well and good for the Big Bash and the A-League at the moment to support those women's competitions because they've got cash coming in. They've got an all right decent amount of cash, although you might have different views on the FFA. But when the broadcasters suddenly turn around and go, you know what, it's not working for us, we can't make any money out of this, they will walk away. They will walk away because there's nothing holding them to the sport. It's all commercial realities. It's like a shareholder. A company doesn't really care for your well-being. It cares about whether the shareholders gets a dividend. And that's what television stations are interested in, and that's where the money for your sport comes from. So it's no good just saying, oh, well, you should support it because it's there. You've got to provide something for us to watch. I look at the women's Big Bash. Yeah, it's great. The girls are out there having a hit and doing their thing. I think it's wonderful. It's brilliant. And it's great they've got a little bit of recognition for doing that. But when I watch the Big Bash Women's League, I notice that the boundaries are about 30 metres in, and the boundaries are already drawn in for a Big Bash game from the boundary fences. I see people that struggle to hit the ball over the boundary that has been brought in, and if they're not careful, people will turn off it because it's an inferior product. It is not as good as the men's game to watch. And I just wonder if people aren't investing too much time and energy in promoting it and making us feel all good about it, And then in 2 or 3 years' time, when the money doesn't roll into the broadcast's coffers, they're just going to dump it and walk away. In the same way that television dumped basketball in this country and walked away from it in the 80s. And it left that sport in a terrible, terrible mess. And this was a top-line men's sport that had great viewership, great crowds, and a great atmosphere around the sport. And it was as simple as a broadcaster walking away, and it fell apart. So I just would like the administrators of sports, and particularly women's sports, not to get too greedy at this stage. If you start going for the big dollars and asking for the big rewards, you will find that you'll bleed yourselves dry, and come the day that the broadcaster turns around, you'll have nothing left in the coffers. That's my opinion.
I feel that with women's sport, I think it's the old thing. You have to go back and look at, why is it being promoted in this way? Why is it to give them parity? Is it to raise the awareness of women's sport? You mentioned that there is money. And what has happened now is the government wants to see all of these sporting codes have a dual sex opportunity, so that there's opportunities for women, there's opportunities for men as well. And funding is now related to that. And that's the scary fact. So what I actually feel, John, is I agree with you on a lot of levels with what you've just said. But what is also happening, and I think, again, it falls at the feet of the administrators, and this is where I believe if government departments are going to give out money, they should be watching why that money is being handed out, what it's being used for, a little bit more closely. Because in some cases, it's just now ticking a box. It's just a case of, we've got to have this women's competition because that will give us X amount of money in the coffers from the government. And I don't think, because to me, if you're going to have these women's competitions, I agree with you, they're going to take time to get to the level where they are viable financially. You're going to make a loss on them for a while because people are not used to it. They need to become aware of the product. But then that, with that comes marketing. And my question is, how many of the competitions you've touched on so far do we genuinely see marketing behind trying to raise the profile of individuals within the sport or even the competition itself?
What really irritates me about this particular subject is the attitude of some of the bigger sports and the attitude to the media who've jumped on board with them. And I'm specifically talking about the AFL here, because let's make it quite plain and clear. If it wasn't for government grants, they wouldn't be jumping into this. They're actually collecting some serious cash out of the federal government for this and their initiative. And what irritates me most is people I respect, like, say, Tracy Holmes. I like what Tracy writes about sport. I enjoy her columns. I don't mind listening to Tracy. I think she's pretty good. And very often thinks outside the mainstream with some of her opinions. When I see her lauding the AFL for what they're doing for women's sport, it makes me want to puke, because there's another sport, other sports in this country that have been making their sport available at the elite level to women without the brouhaha. I'm talking tennis. I'm talking hockey. Don't forget, one of the greatest sporting teams of the 20th century to leave these shores was the Hockey Roos. The Australian women's hockey team of the 80s and 90s. There is no national team that can pull up that record and match it. I'm sorry. They are leaps and bounds ahead of a whole lot of male sport teams. And yet, is any of that recognition forthcoming? No. Oh, the AFL want to have girls play it. Isn't that brilliant? Oh, the world's changed. Have a look around you, people. There are plenty of sports that have been pushing positive women's role models for years and years and years, and sports journalists have just ignored it and taken no notice whatsoever. But the big boy with big deep pockets who's got a lot of money to fork out for journalists that work at its own publishing house, gee, don't they jump on board that bandwagon pretty quick?
And I think the other thing you have to look at there, which I've aired my opinion on this and my worry is, and we've touched on it before, is the AFL now buying into netball. because again, you have to look at the motives behind that. They're not getting into that for netball's sake.
They're getting
into that to tap into a female market that was missing from their demographic to try and pull them into AFL. And I think netball is going to probably rue this mistake. It may not be in 1 year, 2 years. It may be in 4 or 5 years' time. Because in this country, it's not quite the same as whereas you have in some of the Spanish-based countries like Argentina and also Barcelona, where the clubs, if we choose the football clubs, were set up as sporting associations. So you have other sports tacked on to that big club. Australia's never really been like that. And now it's trying to create that. And I just think it's probably 100 years too late to be trying to do that in the modern age. And I don't know if there's too much as well fighting for the limelight. And I just worry about that. But I have to agree with you that there are other sports that have done a great job promoting women's sport, that have uncovered some outstanding female athletes and have funded them, looked after them, promoted them. So, yeah, it is a worry, but I would like to see more emphasis put on the administrators to market it properly and to have a long-term plan on this to make sure that it is successful.
Oh, absolutely. But the bottom line for any sport will always be what people are prepared to watch. And if people aren't prepared to watch it, don't go running around screaming about how much money you should be getting.
And the other thing, sadly, John, that is coming into sport now, and this is globally, this is not just in Australia, it's also coming down to how much people are prepared to pay to watch a game. And the costs to watch live sport now have gone up incrementally over the last 3 or 4 years, and people are now turning around going, I cannot justify taking two children to watch that. It is too much money.
Oh, and on top of that, have you ever tried to buy a soft drink and a hamburger? That's where they get you coming in through the door. And turns into a very expensive night out.
No, it is indeed. Well, we hope you've enjoyed this first edition of a new format of Not the Footy Show. As I say, we'd love to hear from you on Facebook or even leave a comment when you've listened to this podcast, either on iTunes or via our website page, notthefootyshow.com.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over. It gets fouled.
See ya. We'll be back next week.